Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Monticello, Wall Street, the Statue of Liberty, plantations in Louisiana, Galveston's commemoration of Juneteenth. These are some of the places and traditions visited and observed by Clint Smith. Smith spent the past few years traveling the country and at one point ventured as far as West Africa in search of how and why we continue to ignore, overlook, and skew the history of slavery and racial injustice. Drawing on those travels, Smith published his first nonfiction book 2 weeks ago. It's called How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. In case you're wondering how that's going, well, it's already reached the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Perhaps more important than that, How the Word is Passed is quickly becoming a must-read for anyone interested in the origins of our ongoing racial inequities. Esquire called How the Word is Passed, quote, the summer's most visionary work of nonfiction, end quote, and the likes of Annette Gordon Reed have offered similar praise. Today, Clint Smith joins me to discuss the book and wrestling with American history. Clint, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we discuss the book, our listeners should know that you have a local connection. You earned your undergraduate degree at Davidson College, where you recently wrote, you honed an affinity for eating quesadillas at 1 a.m. So how do quesadillas, the big question is, how do quesadillas figure into your work today, Clint?
Oh, man. Well, now I have a four-year-old and a two-year-old. So I've experienced a quesadilla resurgence. I was a 19-year-old experiencing 1 a.m. quesadillas. Now I'm a 32-year-old experiencing, 4 p.m. quesadillas. And sometimes 8 a.m. quesadillas if I'm feeling frisky. I'm a proud Wildcat. Davidson gave me a lifetime of friends and memories, and in many ways made possible what I'm, the fact that I get to make a life as a writer today, which is something that, going into this liberal arts education, I hadn't really conceived of as a possibility. But Davidson is a place that provides so many of us, a lot of space to figure out who we are, to figure out who we are in the world.
And after that, you went on to another university. I wasn't familiar with it. I think it's Harvard, I think is the name of the university. But you were part of a conversation with Davidson College President Carol Quillen this week. Mm-hmm. So you've kept some strong ties. And I guess the thing that I wondered about with your Davidson connection is whether you've had a chance to ask fellow alum Stephen Curry whether he feels overshadowed by your success here in the past couple of weeks.
Well, he was very generous the day the book came out. Tweeted his support, and he's remained a friend throughout his sort of stellar rise to becoming one of the best basketball players of all time, which is just wild. I mean, I remember watching Steph in college, and I was like, man, this kid, he's really good. but we were like the same size then, and then he like grew 5 inches and became one of the best basketball players of all time. It's amazing. And he's just the nicest guy, just the most grounded guy, really humble. So I couldn't be more thrilled for his success. And, now I'm getting, the college sent a tweet out the other day. They were like, the NBA's leading scorer and the number one, New York Times bestseller, are both Wildcats. That's the tweet. And I was like, it's funny to be lumped in with him in that way. I wish I had his three-point shot, but I'll settle for this.
He wishes he had your pen. So, you're even. So let's talk about this book that's doing so well for you. I'm going to work backwards to a degree because I want to explore something you write near the end. And it is this, the quote is, it must be a collective endeavor to learn and confront the story of slavery and how it has shaped the world we live in today, end quote. How much collective will did you see out there? Do you see out there to do that?
I think it depends. I mean, I think part of it is part of what I wanted to do with the book is reflect the sort of inconsistency with which we as a country memorialize and understand our relationship to the history of slavery. I think that the book goes to these 8 or 9 different places, and these places attempt to capture the sort of patchwork of memories that reflect how we do or don't reckon with that history. And so you have a place on one end of the spectrum, like Angola Prison, which is, you know, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that, but that has very little appetite to interrogate its history and its relationship to the history of slavery as it was, is a prison that was once a plantation. And then you have a place like the Whitney Plantation in Louisiana, which is one of the only, it is the only plantation museum in Louisiana that centers the lives of enslaved people and is surrounded by a constellation of plantations where people continue to hold weddings and formal ceremonies. And, you know, I talked to wedding planners who talked about how there were people who used the slave cabins as bridal suites. And so the way that they, that those institutions tell the story of slavery is fundamentally different than the Whitney. And the Whitney rejects the idea that a plantation can be understood as anything other than an intergenerational site of torture and exploitation. And so the way that they tell the story of slavery is both centering on the history of torture and exploitation that Black people experience, but also centering the humanity of enslaved people so that they are not simply abstractions, they're not simply caricatures or invisible faces, but are people with names and identities and dreams and hopes who are living through a set of just unfathomable circumstances that few of us can imagine.
Now let's go back to the beginning a little bit. Early on in the book, you explain where the title originated, how the word is passed. Share that story if you don't mind. It emanates from Monticello, but what's the background of that?
Yeah, so one of the descendants of the Hemings family, the Hemings family being the family, one of the prominent families at Monticello, Sally Hemings was a woman who bore 7 of Thomas Jefferson's children, 4 of whom lived into adulthood. And it is a relationship that, to the extent that, you know, something between an enslaver and the enslaved can be called a relationship, that began when Jefferson was in his 40s and Sally Hemings was just around 15. And so the Hemings are like a very central piece of the history and memorialization of Monticello. And for me, it was really important to make sure that I wanted to understand generally how Monticello was telling the story of Jefferson in all of his complexities. Part of what I wanted to do and part of why I wanted to go to Monticello in the first place is because I think that Monticello reflects the sort of cognitive dissonance of this country and the sort of contradictions and complexity of this country, in the sense that Jefferson is, or that America is, a country that's provided unparalleled, unimaginable opportunities for millions of people across generations to accumulate wealth and build upward mobility in ways that their ancestors could have never imagined. And at the same time, this country is also a place that has created that very opportunity at the expense of millions and millions of other people who have been intergenerationally subjugated and oppressed. And both of those things are the story of America. In the same, and I think that Jefferson personifies that within his own within his own personhood, in the sense that he is someone who wrote in one document that all men are created equal, and wrote in another document that Black people are inferior to whites in both endowments of body and mind. He wrote one of the most important documents in the history of the Western world, and also enslaved over 600 people over the course of his lifetime, including 4 of his own children. And so how does a place, when I go to Monticello, part of what I'm exploring is how does a place like that tell a full and honest story of who this person was, and reckon with the totality of their legacy, and confront the fact that all of the other things that make Jefferson so renowned, his, you know, philosophical ideas, his the way that he imagined the sort of political project of democracy, the letters he wrote, the books he wrote, the speeches he made, that all of that was possible because he had hundreds of enslaved people working to make the other parts of his life possible, to facilitate a sort of lifestyle. And also, how can we understand Monticello as not simply being the home of Thomas Jefferson, but also the home of the hundreds of enslaved people who lived there and who in many ways that land belonged to more than it belonged to him, because Jefferson was away for such long stretches in D.C., Philadelphia, New York, Paris, in his various positions with the U.S. government. And so Monticello was an important place, I think, for me to start, because I think in order to understand how slavery continues to shape the social, economic, and political infrastructure of this country, we have to understand how it is deeply entangled in our founding. And I thought one of the best ways to unpack that was to explore how it manifests itself at the home of one of our founding fathers.
That's the voice of Clint Smith. He is the author of the new book, How the Word is Passed. You are a poet. One of your other occupations, you've been a teacher, you're a staff writer at The Atlantic. As I mentioned, this is your first work of nonfiction in terms of book length. But staying with Monticello for a moment, and reading your book makes clear, words matter. And so much of this conversation that we're having about race and history is not only about the facts, but about the words, the language, how it's couched. And one of the things that really struck me, it's very simple and obvious, but one of the things that struck me is when we talk about Monticello, you almost never hear it called a plantation or a working plantation, when in fact that's exactly what it is and what it was. How do you think we got to that point of not thinking of a slave plantation as anything but a slave plantation?
Yeah, I think it's been part of a decades-long, really centuries-long project of an attempt, in the case of Jefferson, that people sort of denied his relationship to slavery in any way, and most certainly denied that he would have had any children by an enslaved woman, even though if you go back to the late 18th and early 19th century, this was written about in the newspapers. A secret. To the extent that it was a secret, it was an open secret that all of his political adversaries attempted to use to sort of thwart his political career to little success. Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings was reflective of the way that so many white men of that time had children and sexually manipulated and exploited their enslaved workers. And so I think there was an intentional effort from Jefferson's descendants to strip that part of his legacy, or to an attempt to ensure that that was not going to be a part of his legacy, right? If you look at all of the letters and correspondence we have from Jefferson, Sally Hemings is you see her name virtually nowhere. And so part of it is Jefferson being cognizant of the fact that of who he was and how he would be situated in the historical record, and he was deeply cognizant of what he wanted to be present in the historical record and what he didn't. And then also that his children and grandchildren were very intentional about what sort of what they presented or gave over to the world when Jefferson's legacy in the 19th and 20th century was being cultivated. And so I say all that to say, there was an attempt to think of Jefferson sort of singularly as the intellectual founding father of this country, the person responsible for conceiving of the Declaration of Independence, helping Madison write the Constitution, and an attempt to push away any association with his relationship to slavery and the intimacy of his relationship to slavery, in the sense that these were his children. These were a woman who he had a four decades long relationship with. But I think Monticello is also interesting because it is a place that is responsive to political to new information, a place that is responsible to a shift in political consciousness. And so the way that they tell the story now is very different than how they told the story just a few decades ago.
That's Clint Smith. Stay with us. More on How the Word is Passed here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Clint Smith. He is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he has just published his first work of nonfiction. It is already a New York Times bestseller, and it is called How the Word is Passed. Clint, I'd like to ask you to read a passage from your book. It's describing another plantation that you've mentioned a couple of times, which is Angola in Louisiana. It is now the largest maximum security prison in the United States. 75% of its inmates are Black. And in the excerpt that you're going to read, you're on a tour of the prison, and you are listening to a gentleman share the history of the prison, and you have some questions, and I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah. And just to kind of build on what you said for a little bit more context, Angola is, again, the largest maximum security prison in the country, 18,000 acres wide, bigger than the island of Manhattan. 75% of the people held there are Black men. Over 70% of them are serving life sentences, and it is built on what is a former plantation. And so when I'm there, part of what I'm doing is wrestling with to what extent this place is confronting its history or failing to, or in this case, failing to. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the prison's relationship to slavery. I was nervous to ask the question, and I was ashamed of myself for feeling nervous. Roger paused, then nodded. "He's asked me to talk a little bit about the prison's relationship to slavery," he said, repeating my question, perhaps to buy time, or so the people in the back of the bus could hear. "I'll tell you this," he began, readjusting the microphone in his hand, "and I told you this when we came in. This was one of the bloodiest prisons in America. It was a horrible prison." His voice was sincere and steady. "On the way out, I'm going to show you the Red Hat cell block," he said, speaking of the prison's infamous maximum security housing unit that closed in 1972. "And we don't make any bones about it. I can't change what happened here when Samuel James took over the prison. He stumbled over his words as he attempted to finish his thought. "They house slaves on this land, and I can't change that. I think it's an interesting situation that we're in. When you go from that, when you're at a level with some of the worst things that have ever happened on a piece of land in America, this 18,000 acres has seen more than any 18,000 acre piece of property in the world, probably. When you look at it, it's horrible. And when you go from that, and you go years and years and years, and you get to where we are today with the redemption and the change, then that's what I like to talk about. Our history is our history, and I can't change that." Roger went on to share how the prison had sent one of its observation towers to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. The Red Hat cell block was listed on the National Register of Historic Places. More evidence, according to Roger, that the penitentiary was acknowledging its history. He paused, looked around the bus, and smiled. "I'll get off my soapbox," he said, before moving on to talk about the prison's hospice, which we passed on our left. A wave of whispers made its way around the small bus. Roger's, "I can't change that," seemed to provide the pretense of acknowledgement while creating distance from personal culpability. It was reminiscent of a refrain laced throughout the country's conversations about the history of racism. I thought about all the times growing up when I had sat in class and heard a white classmate say, "Well, my ancestors didn't own slaves," or heard a political commentator on television say, "Why are we still talking about slavery? People need to get over it." Or a politician say, "We can't wallow in the past. It's time to focus on the future." When I hear these deflections, I think of all the ways this country attempts to smother conversations about its past and how it has shaped its present. How slavery is made to sound as if it happened in a prehistoric age instead of only a few generations ago. In his 1935 book, Black Reconstruction in America, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote that the story the country tells about its relationship to chattel slavery is willfully distorted. Quote, "Our histories tend to discuss American slavery so impartially that in the end, nobody seems to have done wrong and everybody was right. Slavery appears to have been thrust upon unwilling Americans while the South was blameless in becoming its center. One is astonished in the study of history at the recurrence of the idea that evil must be forgotten, distorted, skimmed over. If in Germany today, there was a prison built on top of a former concentration camp, and that prison disproportionately incarcerated Jewish people, it would rightly provoke outrage throughout the world. I imagine there would be international summits on closing such an egregious institution. And yet here in the United States, such collective outrage at this plantation turned prison is relatively muted."
That's Clint Smith reading from How the Word is Passed. I think that's a really good example of the powerful observations that run through your book. I want to switch gears just a little bit. You know, much of what you saw, as we've already talked about, and what you write about involves history and whose version of history is told. You grew up in New Orleans. You still have family there. And you point out how long and difficult it was to finally have monuments to Robert E. Lee and other Confederate generals removed. Lee Circle was a signature point of New Orleans for decades. And by the way, they were only removed in 2017. The Southern Poverty Law Center, according to National Geographic, has documented nearly 2,000 statues, monuments, memorials, and street names honoring the Confederacy. In fact, as I speak to you, Charlotte is in the process of renaming streets honoring Jefferson Davis and Stonewall Jackson. All of that is to ask, why do you think the iconography in particular remains such a divisive subject? It feels like we have been talking about this forever, or at least ever since Appomattox ended the war.
Yeah, I mean, what it is an intentional effort that has been propagated over the course of a century and a half to distort and sort of create an Orwellian obfuscation of what the history of slavery was and what the history of the Civil War was. So after the war, organizations like the Sons of Confederate Veterans and the United Daughters of the Confederacy attempted to almost gaslight America in a sort of 19th century iteration of gaslighting into thinking that slavery was not one of the central causes and the central cause ultimately of the Civil War. And, you know, they attempted to say that it was states' rights and it was tariffs and taxes and a desire to stave off Northern aggression and the imposition of Northern industrialism into Southern culture and things of the like. But all you have to do is look at the declarations of Confederate secession in 1861 to see what these states said for themselves, right? Like if you look at a state like Mississippi, it said in 1861, as it was seceding from the Union, our position is thoroughly aligned with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest in the world. So this is a verbatim quote from the representatives of Mississippi who are very explicit about
it's
why they're
subtle.
Seceding from
it's
the Union.
It's not subtle.
There's nothing vague about why the Confederacy was seceding from the Union and why the Civil War was about to be fought. And yet part of the insidiousness of white supremacy is that it attempts to turn empirical statements into ideological ones. So if I say the Confederacy was a treasonous territory raised an army predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery, in some classrooms, that would be perceived as me attempting to indoctrinate students with a set of ideological beliefs or with my political sensibilities, when it in fact is again just something that's grounded in primary source documents. It is simply a reflection of what we see in the historical record. But what the Lost Cause attempted to do was, one, it attempted to say, it was an intentional effort, often a state-sanctioned effort, that attempted to say that slavery was not the central cause of the Civil War, even though we have the declarations of Confederate secession that say that it was very directly. It attempts to say that, and slavery wasn't the central cause of the Civil War, and even still, slavery wasn't that bad, so I don't know why everybody's complaining about it. That they talked about it as the late Senator John Calhoun of South Carolina, who was at one point our vice president, he said that slavery was a positive good for both Black and white people alike. Whereas the historian Ulrich B. Phillips in the early 20th century, who was one of the leading historians of slavery in this country and who sort of led the charge that shaped public consciousness around slavery at that point in time, that said that slavery was a civilizing institution and that it sort of rescued Black people from the savagery of Africa. And there were many benevolent slave owners who bestowed Christianity and civilization on these Africans. And what a lot of people don't understand is that was the predominant view of slavery in this country until the mid 20th century, like until the civil rights movement and historians like Kenneth Stamp and a whole generation of social historians began to more accurately center chattel slavery as the origin point for Black-white inequality that we see, certainly that we saw in the mid 20th century when it was less than a century removed. And even still today in 2021, that we can't understand our relationship to, we can't understand the contemporary landscape of inequality without understanding how slavery shaped it in profound ways. And part of what I wanted to do with this book was give us a sense of our proximity to this history, not only our physical proximity, in terms of how close we are physically to the sort of scars etched in the landscape and the topography of this country, but also to our temporal proximity, right? We talk about slavery, as I alluded to in that passage, like it was something that happened in the Jurassic Age, like it was dinosaurs and Flintstones and slavery, as if they all happened at the same time. And the reality is that the woman who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture in 2016, the new Smithsonian Museum, alongside the Obama family, was the daughter of an enslaved person, not the granddaughter or the great-granddaughter or the great-great-granddaughter. She was the daughter of someone who had been born into intergenerational chattel bondage. My grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. So when I think about my four-year-old son sitting on my grandfather's lap, I imagine my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded that this history we tell ourselves was a long time ago, wasn't that long ago at all. But the Lost Cause attempts to distort that and obfuscate that and sort of make it more difficult to understand than it actually is. And as a result, you have statues that are raised as part of that effort across the country to memorialize these men, largely men, who are erected on these statues, and tell a story about them that is not true. And then also these statues are raised at periods in which there were moments of Black political and social and economic mobility, and it was meant as a signal to reinforce white supremacy and terrorize many of these Black communities, to say, you think that you are achieving some measure of political mobility, but let's put a 60-foot statue of Robert E. Lee up in the center of this city in order to show you what our sort of ideological priorities are.
When you talk, think about that gaslighting, as you described it, how much of a direct connection do you see between that and the current age of misinformation and disinformation that, in a lot of ways, is threatening our democracy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to know that it's not new, right? It certainly has been, in many ways, supercharged, if you will, by the age of social media, and it manifests itself in different ways. But you know, in 1865, after the Civil War, you have somebody like the Confederate, the former vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, who in his infamous Cornerstone speech in 1861 said that you know, the African inferiority is that our new nation is predicated on the principle of African inferiority and the effort to engage in chattel slavery in perpetuity is basically the essence of what he said. And then in 1865, the war is over and General Lee surrendered at Appomattox, and people are like, well, what do you have to say for yourself? And he's like, I never said that. And everybody was like, well, what do you mean? It's in the papers. We were there when you gave the speech. We saw. And he's like, no, you must be mistaken. I never said anything like that. And it is this, again, 19th century iteration of gaslighting, where a politician is attempting to tell us that we did not see something that we saw and heard for ourselves. And very clearly, that is something that is happening in all sorts of ways right now. And we see it most perhaps egregiously with everything that's going on with related to what happened on January 6th. And so there is absolutely some historians, I think, are identifying the parallels between the Lost Cause and the Big Lie, and saying that we are now living in an age in which, I mean, we have people who are living in like fundamentally different epistemological realities, right? Where like their people's basis of truth and knowledge are coming from and originating from completely different universes and media ecosystems. And that's a hard thing to push back against. And it, you know, I think the efficacy of the Lost Cause is a warning for us to figure out how to more effectively get everyone, as many people in this country, on the same page. Because if we don't, we will see what the sort of lasting implications of that are in the same that we see it in the landscape of our country today.
Well, we have a, and I'm sure you, I know, because you wrote it, you encountered this in your travels, and I'm sure you hear it as you're now promoting the book and being interviewed. And there are stories like this all over the country. Here in Charlotte, we have a story in the last week that I don't think will surprise you, but I am curious to hear your perspective, which is, there's a plantation here that dates to 1800. It's in Huntersville, not far from your alma mater. They were planning a Juneteenth event this week, and the description of the event included lines such as, quote, "the Massa himself is now living in the woods," end quote, and it referred to Confederates as white refugees who have been displaced. The site manager, who identifies as African-American, has refused to apologize, and you can imagine the political tempest that is going on because it involves a nonprofit and some government funding. The site manager has blamed it on media reports, the uproar over this. They also had scheduled some events for children this summer to teach them how to become a Confederate soldier and to become Southern Belles. Again, I don't think any of this is going to surprise you particularly, but what I am curious about is, from all of the study and examination of this that you've done, is why do these types of wildly different perceptions and ideas persist in our country? Because we are talking about factual matters with slavery and people in bondage and people suffering, and yet it feels very mythical to a lot of our population.
Yeah, I mean, I think what is true is that we just, as a country, collectively do not have any understanding of the history of slavery in a way that is commensurate with the impact that it had on this country. And in any way that is commensurate with or reflective of the sort of nuance and complexity, but also moral clarity that is embedded within it, in the sense that, you know, when I went to Monticello, I met two women, a woman named Donna and a woman named Grace. And after my tour, which was a tour focused specifically on the history of slavery at Monticello, I went up to these two women who were clearly unsettled and unnerved by what they were hearing. And I asked them, like, how they had experienced what we just heard. And Donna and Grace both said it really took the shine off the guy. They said that they had no idea that Jefferson was an enslaver and that Monticello was a plantation. And so these are people who...
Let me interrupt you, Clint, because I want to hear the full story. Stay with us. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to let Clint give us the full context of his day at Monticello, or his days, I should say. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are continuing our conversation with Clint Smith. His new book is How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And Clint, before I rudely interrupted you, you were trying to share a story about being at Monticello and the two ladies you met who were flabbergasted, I think it's fair to say, by what they heard on this tour. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Donna and Grace, and I met them at the Slavery Monticello tour, and they were very clearly unsettled and unnerved by what they had heard about Jefferson and his relationship and his moral inconsistency on slavery and the hundreds of enslaved people who lived at Monticello. And when I asked them, they said, I had no idea that Jefferson owned slaves. I had no idea that Monticello was a plantation. And these are folks who bought plane tickets, who rented cars, who got hotel rooms, who came to this home of our founding father as sort of a pilgrimage to pay tribute to the third president of the United States, and had no conception of him as someone who enslaved hundreds of human beings, or that this was the site of that enslavement. And I think that that's a microcosm of the way that so many people in this country have such a minimal or surface level understanding of what slavery was. And again, part of the insidiousness of white supremacy more broadly is that it makes us feel like we talk about slavery all the time. They're like, oh, all the slavery movies, all the slavery books, all that we've made. Oh, we all, you know, 12 years a slave, Underground Railroad. But again, we don't talk about it in any way that is commensurate with the impact that it had on this country. Slavery existed in this country for 250 years and has only not existed for 150, right? So you have an institution that existed for 100 years longer than it didn't. In 1860, the 4 million enslaved Black people were worth more than every bank, factory and railroad combined, worth more than all the manufacturing that this country had in 1860 were the bodies of enslaved people. And so we can't disentangle the United States as, from existing as a global economic superpower from the fact that it attained the mobility, the economic mobility to make it as such through the bodies of enslaved people, not just in the North, but or not just in the South, but through the North that largely financed and made possible the work that was happening on plantations in the South. And so I think that, you know, no one would ever say there are like too many World War II movies, right? Like, you know, nobody would ever be like, oh man, all this World War II content is too much. You know, like that sounds absurd. There's a World War II movie that's nominated for an Academy Award every year, right? And there's a reason, because it was one of the most consequential things that have happened in the history of the world. And this slavery was one of the most consequential things that have happened in this country and had global implications. And so again, it is there is a very clear difference in the way that we are made to feel when we encounter this sort of information. And on one end, you have, you know, Black people who are like, I don't want to only engage with or encounter Black trauma or Black pain, which I'm 100% sympathetic. And I think we should have media and literature that reflects the entirety of Black history, that represents the heterogeneity and plurality of the Black experience, then represents the spectrum of Black joy to Black pain, all of it. We need all of it. And we can't fall into the trap of thinking that we should not engage with this history or understand this history. Because for me, the process of writing this book over 4 years was more than for anyone else. It was for me. It was like this learning. I learned so much. Like, this book is not a book that is written by like someone who began the project as an expert on the historiography of slavery. I knew a good amount, but I wanted to learn more. And that's why I went on this journey. And so the book is a journey for the reader is a journey to these different places alongside me, so that you are learning these things in the same time. And I wanted to create it in a sort of novelistic way. I didn't want it to read like maybe a traditional history book. I wanted people to feel like they were on this sort of narrative journey. And so, you know, I'm sympathetic to and very much understand that all Black stories should not be about slavery. But on the other end, you have white people who don't want to confront what was done in their name or confront what maybe their ancestors did. You know, like there a guy that I met when I went to Blandford Cemetery, which is one of the largest Confederate cemeteries in the country. And I spent the day with the Sons of Confederate Veterans there.
Petersburg,
Virginia. At the end of the chapter, there's a guy that's like, you want me to accept that my great-grandfather was a monster? And for me, it's like, I don't actually care much about the interiority of your grandfather's spirit or psyche or what's in his heart. So it's less interesting to me if you accept or don't accept that he was a monster. What I'm more interested in is reckoning with the fact that he fought for a monstrous cause. And I think that you don't have to accept and be defined by what your ancestors have done. You are not defined by your lineage. You are not, who you are is not shaped singularly by the people who have come before you. You can make a different set of decisions. And so, you know, to go back to your original question, I think we have to continue to be more honest about how this wasn't that long ago, how it continues to impact this country. And again, how like the political, economics, and social infrastructure we have today are born from this institution. The Electoral College is born out of slavery. Our banking system emerged from a system that was preserving and financing the institution of slavery. Our system of insurance and collateral, I mean, all of it, right, is all deeply entangled in this history. And we can't, the more we learn about it, the less this country is able to lie to us. And for me, that is a deeply freeing experience. It has been a deeply freeing experience. It has been an emancipatory experience, and so liberating, because I feel like I have the language and the toolkit and the framework with which to make sense of the things that I see around me in ways that I didn't before.
That's the voice of Clint Smith. He's our guest today, and his new book is called How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. I want to share a listener email with you. This is from Dennis, and he says, no one really addresses the shame factor surrounding systemic racism. Much of America came to know slavery and racism was morally wrong and were ashamed. That shame led to a centuries-old cover-up. What do you think of that?
There is a lot of shame. I think what happened is the Confederacy or the late Confederates or the former Confederates knew that the way that the world was, the direction the world was moving was away from what they had fought an entire war to preserve. I mean, part of what is not fully known about the Emancipation Proclamation is that part of the reason that it was signed was because the United Lincoln recognized that France and Great Britain, who, you know, historians argue were on the verge of supporting the Confederacy and recognizing it as its own nation, that making the war specifically about slavery in 1863, as the Emancipation Proclamation did, made it so that Great Britain and France, who had by then abolished slavery and understood themselves as anti-slavery countries, were not going to support a new nation that was, you know, it had already very clearly been predicated on slavery. But at that point, there was, you know, the Union was not explicitly fighting to preserve slavery. It was fighting to preserve the Union. But it was always moving in the direction of being a war explicitly about slavery. And in 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation very much made it so. And it prevented Great Britain and France from aligning with the Confederacy in ways that transform the outcome of the war. And so it's not only that the Emancipation Proclamation provided 200,000 new troops for the Union effort that were deeply needed in the form of Black soldiers, but it is also that it prevented other countries from entering the war on the side of the Confederacy because they didn't want to be associated with they didn't want to be allied with a country that was fighting a war specifically to keep people in intergenerational chattel slavery. And that's an important thing, I think, to recognize and to remember about the sort of global implications and the sort of global entanglement of how the Civil War manifested itself.
I want to ask you about, I mentioned earlier, this local controversy over a Juneteenth event. Mm-hmm. Not everyone knows what Juneteenth is. It is dates to June 19th, 1865, and it is when a Union general named Gordon Granger stood up, and this is sort of the myth as you, mm-hmm. as you describe it in your book, told the enslaved people in Galveston and in Texas that the war had ended a couple of months earlier. Emancipation is here. I wanted to get your thoughts on what happened in the United States Senate yesterday when a bill was unanimously passed to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. Assuming that Congress goes along, that will actually happen. I'm wondering whether you see this as anything more than a symbolic nudge. Does it make a big difference? How did you feel when you heard that news?
Yeah, I've not dug into the specifics of it. I think I saw the headlines like everyone else. You know, I'm not someone who believes symbolism doesn't matter. Symbolism.
Whole books about symbolism.
Yeah,
right?
The whole book. I've spent 4 years and 300 pages outlining how symbolism matters deeply. So it does matter. It also very clearly can be, and we have seen this, be used as a performative mechanism to that is presented at the expense of real meaningful material change, right, in ways that impact people's lives. But you know, symbols, as I write in the beginning of the book, when I'm thinking about the origins of this book, which we're watching the Confederate statues in New Orleans come down, you know, I went down streets to get to the school. I went down streets named after Robert E. Lee to get to the grocery store. I went down streets named after Jefferson Davis. My school is named after a former Confederate leader. My parents live on a street named after somebody who owned 150 enslaved people. And so symbols and names and iconography aren't just symbols and names and iconography and holidays. They are reflective of the stories that societies tell. And those stories shape the narratives that communities carry. And those narratives shape public policy. And public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives. So it's not to say that like having a Juneteenth holiday is going to erase the racial wealth gap. Of course not. But it does contribute and has the possibility to contribute to a different set of stories being told and a different narrative taking hold that give us a more acute sense of the historical harm that has been done to millions of people across generations. And hopefully helps, you know, is a drop in the bucket toward helping us recalibrate our history and our understanding of history so that we can make account for and make amends for the harm that has been done to people. Because again, what happens is when you understand what the history of slavery has done, and the history of Jim Crow, and the history of redlining, and housing segregation, and mass incarceration, and mass criminalization, the list goes on and on, then you no longer fall into the trap of looking at one community and thinking that, like, this reason this community looks one way and that community looks another way is somehow because of the people in those communities. But you recognize it as largely being something that is the result of what has been done to those communities generation after generation after generation. And that matters. Like, that matters because I remember being a young Black child in New Orleans, not being told over and over again that there was something wrong with Black people, and not having the language or the framework or the toolkit or the history with which to push back against it. And again, when you gain that, and it didn't happen for me until my adulthood, it's so freeing, because this country can't lie to you anymore. And so for Juneteenth, you know, Juneteenth is both a moment in which we mourn what was kept from Black people, you know, because it is recognition that Black people in Texas were prevented from knowing about their freedom for 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and 2 months after General Lee surrendered at Appomattox. And so you mourn what was kept from Black people and the sort of precariousness of freedom. And you also celebrate the end of the sort of symbolic end of one of the most horrific things that our country has ever done. And it is like many holidays in, you know, like Memorial Day or like so many other holidays where you both celebrate and mourn sort of at the same time. And I am hopeful, you know, we have no control over the way that corporations and companies will, you know, use this to make it seem as if they are committed to equity and diversity and inclusion and a set of values that might not necessarily be reflective in their daily practices. But it does, it's not irrelevant. It doesn't not matter. But it can be certainly manipulated and used by people in ways that try to put a veil over the actual harm they cause. So I think we just need to recognize it for what it is and value it for what it is, and then and call out people when they do things that are inconsistent with the principles of that holiday.
By the way, you mentioned to me before we came on the air that you've been doing about 6 hours of interviews a day. Yeah. I think I could do 6 hours with you, because we haven't even scratched the surface of everything that's in this book. So people are listening. You really need to read How the Word Is Passed. There is so much more that Clint covers and unearths, and we only got to a tiny portion of it. But one thing I do want to ask you before we wrap up is, you're not a historian by trade. As I mentioned, you're a poet, you're a teacher, you're many things. But I'm wondering whether you feel like you have exhausted this subject, or if it has made you want to go even deeper into it. What do you think you're going to do next with your work?
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly not exhausted it. I mean, I think, you know, part of what happens with a book is, like, at least in my case, I didn't finish the book because I was done necessarily. I finished because I had to contractually turn it in. And so, I mean, you know, this book is about 9 places. It could have been about 10,009. This book could have been, you know, this book it's a little under 300 pages because I wanted it to feel accessible, in part because I know what it looks like to look at like a 600, 700 page book and say, like, I can't wait to read that. But like, ooh, I don't know if I'm going to pick that one up right now. And so I wanted it to feel accessible. I didn't want it to feel overwhelming. And so, you know, I limited how many places I wrote about. But slavery existed in this country for 250 years. There's so much to say. The work that so many scholars are doing is so remarkable. And so I don't think this is the last you will hear from me on this subject.
But it is the last that we will hear from you this hour. Thank you so much, Clint Smith, for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, the book is called How the Word Is Passed. Thank you for listening to Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.